Okay, everyone. As always, I want to return to a few things. And again, thank you, Rabbi Kelman, for that. Just pick up on a couple things because someone asked me about this. I remember I showed you last class in the book of Nehemiah. Here it is in verse 8. While I was going through, verse 8, it says, Halviim, Yeshua. It mentioned, and then it says, other people, Binoy, Kadmiel. Well, first of all, by the way, for our Baalei Kriya here, this word v'halviim, it appears also in Chumash a lot, in the laning. That actually is pronounced halviim. It's not pronounced with a shvan na halviim. I think the Baalei Kriya all know that it's v'halviim, but it's of interest that if you look in the Art Scroll and you look at the Koran in the Shir Shalyom, for some reason they have at the beginning, the first verse in Shir Shalyom, Ha-Leviim. They turn it into a Shvana, and I don't know how they get this. What they're going to say that the sitter is punctuated differently than Tanakh? On what basis do you say that? For whatever reason, there are some words that after the hey, ha, there always is the dagesh, like Hamelech. Other than Rabbi Weider, no one really pronounces it, but Hamelech. But you have the but there are. And by the way, why is there a dagesh? Because originally ha would be ha hey lamed, like in Arabic al the, so it would be hey lamed, but the lamed is dropped, so it just becomes ha. So it's not ha-melech, it's ha-melech, so you put a dagesh in the mem. There are some words that when the letter after the hey takes a shva, there's no dagesh. It's not consistent, like hakadoshim. That take the kuf takes a dagesh, but halviim is one of them that it doesn't take a dagesh. So again, if you're a Baal Kore, you should read halviim, and I believe that when you do Shir Shalyom, you should also say halviim. That's the Masorah, how to pronounce it. But the next word is Yeshua, and I said that this is an abbreviation of shortened form of Yehoshua. So someone asks, well, what about like salvation or something? But notice it doesn't have a hey at the end of it. We have, incidentally, and no Jew would name them their son Yeshua, obviously, but they do have, people do name their kids, or at least their nickname is Shua. We all know the name Shua. So Shua is an abbreviation of Yeshua, but no one's going to use the abbreviation after Jesus of Yeshua. Although in the Sephardic world, you had people who were named Yeshua with a hey at the end. But this is an abbreviation. This has nothing to do with this word has nothing to do with salvation. Although interestingly enough, if you look in the Tashbetz, and there's others as well, but the Tashbetz most famously, he says that the reason Jesus is called Yeshu is because he was not able to be Moshiach even himself. He couldn't even save himself. And therefore, you don't call him Yeshua, you call him Yeshu. Others have a less charitable understanding that Yeshu is an abbreviation of Yimach Shemo V'Zichro or something like that. Okay, but how do I know this? Well, if you look, there's a few proofs for it, because we have the word Yehoshua used parallel sometimes with Yeshua. But you can just look also in Nehemiah, just an earlier chapter, chapter 8, verse 17. What does it say? It says that all the congregation, they dwelled in Sukkot because they hadn't made Sukkot when? Since the days of Yeshua ben Nun, since the days of Yehoshua. Yeshua ben Nun is obviously Yehoshua. And this idea, by the way, that they didn't sit in Sukkot, I think I'll get to that in a second with something else responding, if I get to it today, to Bezalel's comment. I actually think the reason for this is probably that they had this conception that, which was mistaken, but they had the conception that since the sukkah represents, it's all about that they were on the move, not a permanent dwelling. Once they come into Eretz Yisrael, now they have a permanent dwelling. What's the point of having a sukkah? The whole point is when they're temporary dwellers. But of course, the mitzvah dafka is to have it even when we're dwelling where we are now. Okay, we spoke last class about what type, what is avelos, what is not avelos, what is tshuva And what is musser? Is it supposed to upset you, put you in a dour, very stern mood, or is, happiness? The distinction between the approach of the Altar of Subotka versus others. And then I raised the issue of can an Avel learn musser? And we said the nafkamina, the practical difference would apply whether it was the sad sort of musser that's going to upset you, or the happy stuff. And I quoted Rav Vlad Yosef. Another interesting question along these lines is, can you learn musser on Shabbos? I mean, Shabbos is supposed to be a time of oneg, uplifting. So can you learn musser? So Rav Sternbach, in his Tshuvos von Hagos, volume 1, number 546, raises this question, and he quotes Rav Chaim Rappaport, one of the Gedolim of previous centuries, who quotes Poskim, "Sh'asur l'mod musar b'Shabbos, mipnei sh'amusar mevi atzavus b'Shabbos, asur l'yosat sev," because it's musar brings unhappiness, and therefore you don't want to learn musar. You can't sit, have a musar shmooze also telling you how bad you are, and how all the terrible things are going to happen. And he says this is questionable, because the Vilna Gaon, and he's a descendant of the Vilna Gaon. In the Vilna Gaon's, I have his Egeris here. Is the Vilna Gaon's famous letter. A lot of people only remember that he tells the women, don't go to Shul, stay home, because there's lots of Lashon Hara going on in Shul. But he also says in the letter that this is when he supposedly, when he's leaving to go to Eretz Yisrael, he says that I have in my possession in my house a number of books of Musar in, it says, in Moshon Ashkenaz. That means in Yiddish. He says, read them always. V'chol shekein b'Shabbos Kodesh Kodoshim, lo yisasku el b'sifrei Musar. He says to his wife and daughters, on Shabbos Dafka, that's the time you should read Musar. So Rabbi Sternbach doesn't accept this, and he says that Sifrei Musar, to learn Yiras Hashem and Midos Shavos, that's also a mitzvah on Shabbos. But I think he would agree that we're not talking about the sort of Musar that upsets you. Incidentally, on Shabbos, as we know, well, we don't have regular yeshiva, regular learning on Shabbos generally. Other things, but sometimes people will learn to have Daf Yomi on Shabbos. Sometimes the rabbi gives a Gemara Shiur on Shabbos. But in Gerba, for instance, the students go to yeshiva basically every day of the year, except for on certain holidays. But they go every week on Shabbos. They go to yeshiva. So after lunch, they head back to the yeshiva and they learn. And we don't do that. We give our kids a break. But in Gerba, they have no vacation, no Elul, sorry, no time off before Elul, no time off before Pesach. They literally are learning every single day of the year, except for like Tisha B'Av, Yom Kippur, that sort of thing, and maybe Pesach, but every Shabbos. But the Gemara is not so, it's not so pashut, as we say in Yeshiva, that you can learn Gemara on Shabbos. In fact, the Yerushalmi, in Shabbos, Perek Tesvav, Halacha Gimel, quotes one opinion that you shouldn't. Hold on, where is it? Let me find. I have the Yerushalmi here. Yes, it's Rav Shulba Nachman. He says that Shabbos is only given. The rabbis won't like this, but this is in the Yerushalmi. Listen to this. This is Rabbi Chagai b'shem Rabbi Shulba ben Nachman. Lo nisnu Shabbosos yomim tovim elo la'achila ushtia. That's the point of the Shabbos and holidays, to enjoy and to eat and drink. And you're not supposed to learn on those days, mikra din. You're supposed to focus only on achila and ushtia. But then he says, because the pez ela, he says, why does he change it? But since, if you're not learning, your mouth's going to get involved in all sorts of bad things. Lashon Hara, Devarim Batalim, etc. Then what does it say? He tiru bahen b'divrei Torah. So he says that it's like a b'diavad. Because we're going to be doing things we shouldn't be doing on Shabbos, therefore it's a heter to learn on Shabbos, really. So that's not usually how we think about it. Usually we think about it as the next opinion site of Rabbi Rechia says, in the name of Rabbi Rechia, lo nisu shabosos yom tovim ela lasok ben batorim. So the opposite opinion that the reason you can't work and everything on Shabbos is dafka so you can learn, and eating and drinking, of course, is an additional, but learning is the main thing. And there are questions and people who hold, though, however, that you should not learn too much in depth on Shabbos. Don't focus too much in learning on Shabbos. That is, keep it more of a surfacey level, precisely for this reason that it'll you'll detract from the time. In fact, I'll cite you. This is a Farish Gemara here. Here it is in Shabbos. Here it is, 119. At the bottom of the page, 119a, it says, in the summer, Rav Sheshes would seek the sages who would attend his lecture in a place where the sun would reach. In the winter, he would seek the sages in a place where the shade would reach. He did this so they would stand quickly after the lecture ended and not engage in discussion, which would detract from the time devoted to delighting in Shabbos. And then it says, Rav Zera would seek pairs of sages engaged in conversation on Shabbos, conversation of Torah, and said to them, don't desecrate the Shabbos of failing to delight in Shabbos. So we see here, you don't want to get into too much learning, too much sugyos, too much involved, because that makes you focus and your head gets, we all know what it does to our heads if we're trying to understand the difficult Tosfos and everything. And that's not what Shabbos is about. And therefore, like I said, we have this concept that people say you shouldn't learn in any significant way on Shabbos. Okay, I said last class that you couldn't get the Soloveitchik Heritage, the book by Meiselman, and Dov, thank you very much for sending me a copy of it. I'm very grateful. But as was pointed out for me, you can get it. It's just look at the price on Amazon, $247. Okay, you want to get it? It's expensive. When I said you can't get it, I didn't mean it's literally impossible to get, but it's very expensive. Although I saw on eBay you can get it for only $200. So those who really need to have the book, it is available. You can get it. I see it's already 8:45, so I'm going to hold off on the last two things about the Kuzari proof and also, Moshe from Lakewood, your very interesting comment about. I'll get to that next class. I'm sorry I didn't get to it today. We will get to it next class. And if, well, we'll definitely get to next class. I'll put it at the top of my things to do. Okay, let us pick up. We're in the middle of Sabakka, the second Musar dispute. And those of you who want to check the sources later, you can look in Katz's book, Humus HaMusar, page 266. I think the last thing I mentioned was that beginning in 1901, Big Machlokas breaks out again, and the yeshiva splits into two separate sections. People sitting separately, just like in Ponovitch today. Two separate yeshivas, basically. Katz points quotes Dvorts, who says that the yeshiva create an entirely new really tzura form of the yeshiva, that the siddurim of the yeshiva were weakened, many of the yeshiva students, in particular those who were interested in this rebellion, they stopped coming to davening on time, they stopped focusing as much on learning. I will say, though, this idea of being medaktek in davening, it's an old Lithuanian tradition. They would stay up to 2, 3 in the morning learning, so they wouldn't always be able to get up for minyan. And it was regarded as acceptable. In the Lithuanian yeshiva world, if you couldn't get up in time for minyan, they didn't look down upon you for that. Because look, in the Lithuanian yeshiva world, like the Chassidim, at the end of the day, learning is more important than davening. We might have a problem with this hyper-intellectualism that, davening is something we do to get, but we have to get back to learning. That's the most important. But that's in the Lithuanian world. They say, in fact, Chaim used to daven very quickly. What is it? The Rambam says that they said to him, you're supposed to daven like you're counting money. Who says that? Like focus on it. And he said, apparently, well, I count money quickly also. I mean, that's, I've spoken about that in the past as well. But, and he says that the time of, Musar learning, this was almost mavatal. They almost were mavatal it, that you couldn't learn anymore because the opponents of it were making such a balagan and a problem. So what do you expect of the Alter Sobotka to do? The first time this happened, what is it, 6 years ago or so, the Alter picks up with his loyalists and they leave the Beis Medrash. They say, we're forming our own yeshiva, even though by all rights he should have kicked out the other people, even though they were the majority, but it was his yeshiva. But the Alter was one always to flee from Machlokes, and he said, fine, they want to have this sort of yeshiva, I'm leaving. He didn't do that this time. But he also didn't expel the troublemakers, like was done in other yeshivas when you had rebels. And in fact, the administrators of the yeshiva, the other people involved in running the yeshiva, wanted the Alter to expel these students, but he refused to. Not only that, we have testimony that even the troublemakers, he tried to be nice to them, friendly to them, bring them close to him. In fact, one story that Dvoretz mentions is that one of the main figures, central figures in the rebellion, remember the rebellion isn't just against Musa, the rebellion is against the Alter. They wanted to get rid of him. They didn't believe there should be a mashgiach. That's the Alter's job, to speak Musa. And there he had another Musar Mashgiach with him. They didn't want him in there. So one of the opponents, he was called up for the army. And what do Jews in Russia do when they're called up for the army? They get out of it. That's what they would do. And they would, through bribery, they would get a doctor to declare that they weren't healthy, they couldn't see properly. There was all sorts of ways. Kesef Yana Sakol, you know, if you had the money, you could get out of it, and no Jew wanted to be in the anti-Semitic Tsarist army. So one of these, the student who's the leader in the anti-Musar forces, he comes to the Alter, or I shouldn't say that, the Alter knows about this, and the Alter, the fact that this boy is the big troublemaker, the Alter doesn't care. He tried, and he got other people in the yeshiva, all everything they could do to raise money, everything that's needed, to be meshacharer him, to exempt him from the army. Basically, he turned over worlds, Dvorak says, even taking money from the yeshiva itself, which was hardly rich, to help this student who, and by the way, Dvorak says that after this, despite the fact that the Alter did this for him, the student remained a at the head of the opponents of Musar. Matters get worse. Dvoretz tells us that during the middle of the Musar dispute, one of the anti-Musar figures hits one of the loyalists, the pro-Musar students, on the head with a stick. And if you find it hard to believe, like I said, I've shown you videos before. I don't need to show it again. You can go on YouTube and find it, or I can send it to you if you want. You can see the fight in Ponevezh, in which they threw chairs at each other and other things. Now, the fight in Ponevezh is only about power. Who's going to run the show there? And the students, of course, they have loyalty to different Rosh Yeshiva. I think a lot of it is if these guys were to go out and play a little basketball, have some outlets, that young men need outlets, some exercise, do some jogging or something, then they you wouldn't have this. But literally, these guys are not like American guys. You go to the Scranton Yeshiva right near where I work, and right in the back there you have a basketball court. And I go over there sometimes because I get food there, and you got the yeshiva guys playing basketball between the siddur, and that's a good American thing. But in Bnei Brak in Ponevezh, they don't do that. They literally have no outlets. And therefore, if it's a chance to go crazy like this, throwing chairs and doing that, that's what they do. I remember when I was in yeshiva in BMT in 1984 to 1985. So right, it's between Beit Vegan and Givat Mordechai. So there's a there's a there were a bunch of Americans in Beit Vegan, and I got to know some of them. In fact, because we used to go. Today it's different, but in those days, at least at my yeshiva, if you wanted, they had a list, the office of all the people who were wanted to host, And it was always Americans. It was once the blue moon Israelis, so we never learned Hebrew because the yeshiva was English speaking, and all the hosts on Shabbos were English speaking. But all these Americans out of YU guys, but not just YU guys, Haredi types in the area who aren't host Americans. It's a big mitzvah. It's very nice. So they would BMT had their numbers, and if you want to go away for Shabbos, they would call up, and you tell them you come in Wednesday. They'd make a call, and then they tell you you're going to so and so. For Shabbos. And I used to like to go to people in Beit Vagar because I used to just walk there. Unlike today, where the yeshivas have out Shabboses and BMT, you never had to leave. You could always stay in. So on out Shabboses, sometimes everyone left. I remained. It was great. It was just me and the Gris Kolo guys, but it was very nice. Okay, so I got to know some of the people in Beit Vagar, and they would have like a basketball game, the Americans. These are American yeshiva guys types. Who are living in Israel now, so every Friday they get together and they'd have like a basketball game. I don't know where the basketball court is. By the way, it's a basketball court in the old city of Jerusalem, I can tell you, because my son's played on it. But so one of the guys mentioned, he said that the Israelis, because there's a number of yeshivas up there, like Israeli yeshivas, he says the Israelis regard them, and this is his language, as shkatzim. That is, the Israelis thought that all the American Haredim were shkatzim because once a week, Erev Shabbos, a few hours before Shabbos, they would get together and play some ball. And from the Israeli mentality, that's impossible. Okay, so one student hit another student on the head. And this happened, it says, on Erev Shabbos, and this created the whole Shabbos. Everyone was up in, all emotionally. This created all sorts of tension over Shabbos. Not only, and what did they do? They brought the student on Sunday to the yeshiva. And they surrounded him, the one who hit the other student, because they were afraid he would be tossed out, as many people wanted to toss him out, especially the other people. He says, when he says the Rosh Yeshiva wanted to throw him out, that would be Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein. But they brought him to the yeshiva and they protected him, so they can't get rid of him. And nevertheless, the alter, despite physically hitting someone, the alter refused to put shum onesh, not any punishment, not on the bachor who hit the guy or on his friends. And not only that, he agreed to meet with them for an hour or so to talk about the issues with them. So fascinating. It goes on. Now, this Katz explains that this would go on until 1904, 1905. So you're talking 3 years or more, even 3 to 4 years. This was a machlokas, a dispute in the yeshiva. I mean, the Ponovezh dispute's been going on longer than that. And in 1904, 1905, he says that a tzura chamura, that is, it became even worse in the yeshiva. Remember, that's the year, that's the time when the revolutionary fever, when the rebellion is going on in Russia, and the Jews got really tied up with this. And many, many yeshiva students were caught up in this as well. There were yeshivas, there were students in Knesset Yisrael, in Slabodka, who were active in the Russian underground, they would go on the streets carrying the revolutionary flag. These are yeshiva students, and one of them, this is what I mentioned last class, and Moshe from Lakewood got it. Shkoyach to you, Moshe from Lakewood. I asked which student, and he guessed it. Sidney Hillman. Sidney Hillman was an American labor leader, very involved in the New Deal, but he was the son of the rabbi of Zagor, that's in Russia, and he was in Slabodka. And it talks about here this, but it was hoped that Sidney would follow in the Hillman family tradition by becoming a rabbi. Things, however, did not proceed as planned, however. While in Slabodka, he began to attend the secret meetings of an illegal study circle headed by a local druggist, et cetera, et cetera. And look, we've seen the story again and again that the best and the brightest sometimes were led astray, and that's that happened there as well. And that's mentioned by Katz on page 267. He also mentions that the students who were revolutionaries, they were also anti-Musar, which you can understand that they said things like, Mussar wants to control us. It wants to restrict our freedoms. It goes against modern ideas, etc., etc. So once they started adopting revolutionary fever, they personally, what Itaki tells us, the Altar of Slobodka, they published, it says, proclamations on these. They would publish these, on this, the way they would be able to publish cheaply in those days, in which they attacked the altar, they attacked Mussar, and they demanded that the altar be fired. And that this, if you look in the literature, there was in the Haskalah newspapers, they would publish letters from yeshiva students with complaining. Were these real letters or were these invented letters? I don't know, but complaining about the administration, you have to get rid of the altar, things like that. And then he tells us that one day a group of students came to the altar's house and one of them had a pistol in his hand. And they threatened the altar that he has to stop his Mussar activities. And he says, he doesn't tell us who this is. Later on, we have a similar story, but I'm going to tell you who it is about the Telz Yeshiva. He just says that one of the leaders of the rebels, Baal Kishronos Gedolim, very talented student, who was regarded as one of the best students of Slobodka. I would love to know who that is. I mean, he told us who Sidney Hillman is because Sidney Hillman ends up leaving the Torah world, so Katz has no problem saying who the troublemaker was. But he doesn't want to tell us who the troublemaker is if the troublemaker is then repents of his ways and becomes a regular rabbi, Talmud Chacham, because he doesn't want to embarrass him. So you can be sure that's what's going on here. And he says that this student, who was one of the top students in the yeshiva, declared that as long as Mussar is not removed from the yeshiva, they're not going to stop, and either you're going to remove Mussar from the yeshiva or they are going to destroy the yeshiva. And when you get rhetoric like this, you can expect what's going to happen next. An anonymous person, Gana v'sifrei ha-Mussar v'shlichosam o'makom bazoi. It says that a someone stole the Mussar yeshivas and threw them in a makom bazoi. Makom bazoi has to mean an outhouse, a latrine. That is, they've been so misled or so driven to extremism that they couldn't distinguish between Mussar that they're opposed to and the holy Mussar books. Remember what we saw already? All the opponents of Mussar acknowledge that Ramosha Chaim Watzlato's works are holy, and the Ram and Rabbeinu Bachya's works. All these works are holy. The only issue was, how much time do you focus on it? Do you create a whole movement, a cut? Do you create separate base medrash? Do you need to have separate times? But once people, what's the expression? Hutra Haritzua. Once things get going, then you can't stop it. So someone thought that he was serving the cause by taking the Mussar books and degrading them like that. It's this story, this event of debasing, degrading the Sifrei Mussar, Katz tells us, shocked everyone, even the opponents of Mussar. And there was a whole ceremony. They buried the Mussar books. There was a kavura of them. And with thousands of people coming there, and you know who gave hespedim on this? One of the people who gave a hespedim on this, by which I mean talking about how terrible this was the Rav of Slobodka, Moshe Donashevsky, who we know was a leading opponent of Mussar. But it's one thing to be opposed to Mussar; it's another thing to degrade books which are part of the classic Torah library. That's terrible. And then Katz tells us that this event affected the conscience of the head of the one who's responsible for leading the rebellion, and he left the yeshiva after this. But he says still the machlokes continued, and Katz mentions that nevertheless the altar refused to change his position. He refused to expel anyone, refused to get rid of anyone, and but he stopped appearing in the yeshiva. He couldn't appear in the yeshiva with all the opposition there. He had a special minion in his house. The students would come to his house and he would give his Mussar shmooze, but he would not do it in the yeshiva itself. And he refused to, as I said, be pogeya on any of the anti-Mussar yeshivas. He never expelled any student. And then the cat says that his followers couldn't understand why he isn't even gonna expel anyone. But later they understood, because through this method of tolerance, continuously forgiving them, he was, even though this went on for a few years, eventually the opposition lessened, and some of the students left the yeshiva, but some of the opponents of Musser actually came to admire Rav Nosson Zvi Finkel when they saw how he, to use the Christian expression, turned the other cheek. But we'll see next class, thank you, Moshe, that it's actually, is it a Christian expression? Yes, the Christians use it, but as we'll see, I mean, it's in Tanakh as well. So I want to talk about that expression, which we always assume, we always associate with Christianity, turn the other cheek. It's from the Sermon on the Mount, but, and I mentioned last class that Rabbi Greenwald said that's Dafka why in the Gemara you have stories about how the sages, that their bite is like, you know, a strong bite, and you have to be careful not to offend the sages, they're going to get you, to show that we're not like the Christians, and that if someone offends you, you can, you don't have to turn the other cheek, but we'll get to turning the other cheek next class. But he didn't, he turned the other cheek, and slowly by 1905, and this is also when the rebellion fails in Russia, the revolution, it's it really declines, the revolutionary fever, and once again Shalom v'shalva al Knesset Yisrael, on peace returns to the great yeshiva, the great Musar yeshiva, and everything continues as it was. One more point before we move on, that Katz mentions that, oh, first of all, from that point on, he says there were no more disputes until the end of the, until the Holocaust. You never again had disputes over Musar in the Slobodka Yeshiva. He made certain changes after everything calmed down. Then the Alter said that it used to be before that only special students were allowed to enter his house and hear his schmoozing. Now anyone could come who wanted to come. And we understand beforehand he didn't want to take a chance on letting in the troublemakers, but now there are no more troublemakers. He let everyone in, and he also says that he's changed the content of the sichos, and now he spoke about, mostly spoke about Elyonos Adam, the greatness of man, and how great is every Masa Tov and Hirhor Tov, et cetera, et cetera. He also says, Katz, that this approach of the Alter Slobodka also lessened the opposition to the to Musar by the rabbis. He would, the fact that he would help the opponents of Musar in their yeshivas, he would, eventually they started asking him to send yeshiva bacharim, he sent yeshiva bacharim, et cetera, et cetera. So everyone began to admire him. Even, remember Rabbi Yitzhak Yaakov Rabinovich, or Itzel, who we said was one of the leading anti-Musar figures, who had originally taught at Slobodka, and then was, he was one of the top signers of the document Laman Das, which said all sorts of terrible stuff about Slobodka Yeshiva. When he was appointed Rav, well, Rosh, we'll call it kibbutz, like a Rosh Yeshiva in Ponevezh in 1908, who does he turn to? The Alter of Slobodka. And the Alter of Slobodka to send him yeshiva students, send him the best yeshiva students. And the Alter of Slobodka could have said, "You got to be kidding. The way you attacked me, but that was, he didn't say that, because that was 10 years before. And the fact that Vitzel Aponovich turned to the Alter Sobotka is a recognition, even if he wouldn't say so outwardly, that he was wrong. And remember Rabbi Borstein? We spoke about Rabbi Borstein, the Rav of Tavrig, who was also, together with Vitzel Aponovich, the leading anti-Musar figure. When I say anti-Musar, I don't mean like in a Reb Chaim Soloveitchik sort of way, where it's a, an intellectual opposition of Musar. I'm talking about personal attacks on the leaders of Musar and on the students and everything they do. When he established a yeshiva, kibbutz bachurim, it's not a yeshiva, it's a group of yeshiva students who would study with him, as super advanced ones. He turned to the Alter, sent him students. And in 1911, the Alter sent him students. And it goes on. When Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, the son of Reb Chaim, was appointed Rav in Rassein, he was in Rassein and in Chaslovich, and then he comes to Warsaw. The Rebbeim asked the Alter to send him students, and he sent him students. And he established a yeshiva there. And even Knesset Beis Yitzchak, even the yeshiva that broke away, the anti-Moshe yeshiva in Slobodka, he tells us that the Alter never did anything against it. On the contrary, he was friendly to the students there. And there were students. He set up among those students chaburas to study Musar. I don't know how happy Knesset Beis Yitzchak was, but it's true. In fact, Harry Austin Wolfson, the great Harry Wolfson, the expert in Jewish philosophy, the leading scholar in Jewish philosophy in the 20th century, he actually, before he went to Harvard, he was in Scranton. He went to teach in a Hebrew school in Scranton, one of these old-fashioned Haskalah Hebrew schools where you learned Hebrew and they met every day, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. From there, he goes to Harvard. He was a student at Knesset Beis Yitzchak, but he recalled he would walk over to the Musar Yeshiva, Knesset Yisrael, because that's where you could hear the Alter of Slobodka. It was worth going over there. Okay, that's all I want to say from here in Pulmos HaMusar with Slobodka. Let me mention, though, the son of the Alter, which I mentioned last class. I think I might have said last class that the one exception was the Alter's son. The Alter himself, if you read carefully in Tnuas HaMusar, actually, I looked, I wanted to be careful. I went online and I looked in the Alter here, Wikipedia. This is, oops, hold on, I gotta share my screen with you. If you look in the Wikipedia article on the Alter of Slobodka, it gives you his sons here, as you see. And then it says at the bottom, Ben Nosaf, he had an additional son, B'shem Reuven. Reuven Lamad b'yeshiva Slobodka, he learned in Slobodka, but because he was involved in Haskalah, he was removed from the yeshiva by the Menahal Ruchani, that is, I guess you would say, the spiritual guy, the Mashgiach, that's what it is, but the lesser Mashgiach, not the top Mashgiach, without the knowledge of his father. That is, they got rid of Reuven without his father's knowledge. And because of this, he went to America. And I told you that story that he went to America, and I don't know who his descendants are if he married. They're not in our world, the Torah world. Now, the source that's given for this, if you look in the note here, is Tnuas HaMusar, Volume 3, page 294. So I have that in the book here. And that volume deals with the Alter Slobodka. It's not exactly it says as follows. It says among the students who rebelled at that time was the son of the Alter, Reuven. That is, he became a communist type or a revolutionary. And then it says that hirchiku oso me'yeshiva. They, that is not his father, but they separated him, pushed him out of the yeshiva. And it says, Rav Talitzvi, the Alter, hitzta'er al tzad zeh kol yamav, that he regretted this all his life. Now, it's hard to see how. It's his yeshiva, it's his son. It's hard to see how the second in command could get rid of the son of the Alter without the Alter's permission. Unless what happened is that he spoke to this Reuven, he said, you're causing your father great pain. It's terrible. It's untenable, your position here. You really need to leave. And don't cause your father any more tsaros by going to him and complaining. You're destroying his life by saying it's bad enough that the other students are doing this. For him to see you every day as rebelling, that's destroying him. And because of that, he left and went to America. That's possible what happened. In fact, I would say that's likely. And maybe that's what it means, Sher Chikulo so. But I mean, the implication is perhaps that they threw him out because that's what it says in the Wikipedia article that he was removed. But whatever it is, whatever the exact details are, the Alter himself, according to Katz, didn't himself throw out his son. It could have been also that they went to the altar and said, "We can't have him here. We can't have him here." And he said, "Well, do what you think needs to be done." In other words, he can't throw his son out, but you do what you think needs to be done. And of course, he's very upset, but what can you do? That's also perhaps likely. It says, then in the next paragraph, he says that, well, in the end of that paragraph, it says that the altar shita was She'ein you can't give up hope on anyone, even into the last moment. You have faith in them. But at the end of the day, if you're running an institution and you have students who are troublemakers, you got to get rid of them. So either they convinced Reuven to leave on his own and basically pressured him to leave, or the altar said, "You have to do what has to be done, but I can't get rid of him." Whatever it is, he was pushed out. Now, a couple other things about Savatka before we move on to tells. You know, when you deal with these students, these rebellious students, the students caught up in revolution, let's not forget, and I mentioned this before, but let me just elaborate a little bit, that having a whole Musar regime there, and it's not just the altar, it's his assistant, it's others they have, watching the students carefully. They tried to watch Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg. You know, they wanted to put a spy in Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg's room. They wanted to put a spy in Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg's room to make sure that he wasn't reading Haskalah stuff. But that's part of the problem. Many of the students, even the students who wanted to remain religious, they wanted to be broad. They wanted to be involved in Haskalah. They wanted to be involved in Zionism. Those are the two great forces which had influenced the yeshiva. And the it was easy to do that in Volozhin because they didn't really have a mashgiach the way a Musar mashgiach. They had a mashgiach, but it wasn't so all-encompassing. And it wasn't a Musar yeshiva, Musar mashgiach in the early years. So if you get rid of the whole Musar environment there, it's a lot easier for them to focus on Haskalah, Zionism, together with Gemara, because they were Talmidim. Now, it's also true, it needs to be said, I think I mentioned this already, that the altar created an aristocracy of people that were loyal to him, and he gave them additional honors because he even gave them additional money. Stipends. He thought this would encourage excellence in an institution that was elitist in any event. But we know that that caused resentment, that he's favoring certain people. In fact, some of those he favored, he even asked them to live in his house. The Rav of Kovno, the later Rav, the last chief rabbi of Kovno, Avram Dov Ber Shapiro, said that the altar's love for his Talmidim, for students, is greater than the love of a father for his only son. And you get examples of this in Kamenetsky's book. And in my review of Kamenetsky's book, review number two, I had two reviews. I had one review, and then they asked me, 20 years later, is it, yeah, to write a another review, or not like a retrospective on Making of a Gadol. It appeared in the Jewish Review of Books. You can see it online, or I can send it to you. And I said that a psychologist could have a field day with this because you're a child of someone, and it's you know that your father doesn't put you on the pedestal and doesn't favor you. He favors other people. What does that do to someone? I mean, I can't even imagine, but that's the situation of the altar's children. They knew that when it came to the children and the yeshiva students, they were not favored over the yeshiva students. And I can't see that any psychologist today would say that's healthy, because even if you're the Rosh Yeshiva and you have to love your Talmidim, your basar, your flesh is your flesh. And yes, what do the Gemara say? Everyone is jealous of people. Chutz mi benova Talmido. You're jealous, except for your student and your child and your student. But at the end of the day, your child is your blood. And you could see how this could do numbers on children if they don't think that their parent is focusing primarily on them. But that was the case. And what Rabbi Yehuda Yaakov Weinberg, he discusses the dispute, the second dispute, but he doesn't go into it in the detail that he should. So, for example, He doesn't tell us in his published writings. We only have in his private writings that he was persecuted. When I say private writings, I mean we have a letter actually wrote to Dov Katz, which for some reason Dov Katz never published this letter in his writings. He's published other stuff. One day I'll publish it. In a private letter, he revealed that he was persecuted by the opponents of Gnosis Finkel. He was so close to the altar that the opponents of Musser persecuted him as well. They were jealous, he says, of the honors. The altar gave him great honors. The altar of Sobotka's predicted. I heard this from Rav Yaakov Chaim Sarna, the son of Rav Yecheskel Sarna. In other words, the grandson of the altar, who would have heard it from his father, that the altar predicted that the Sridi Yeshu of Weinberg would be the Gadol Hador, the undisputed sage of the generation. Now, it never happened. Perhaps for the personal issues that the Rabbi Weinberg went through, which to a certain extent the altar was responsible for. The altar was the one who told Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg to marry this girl, the daughter of the Rav of Pilveshuk, who the altar and Rabbi Weinberg's parents, but I don't know if he would have listened to his parents, but when the altar said to marry her, because then you get the shtetl of the position, the father of this girl in Pilveshuk, the city, died. And he had a 17-year-old daughter, and if you marry the daughter, you get the rabbonus. So it's a good deal. And it's we understand why the community would do this because the rabbinic contracts in Eastern Europe were written that if a rabbi dies and there's a widow, the community still has to support the widow. That is, she has a house; they have to keep. She can remain in that house. These were poor communities. Otherwise, they have to keep her in that house, and then they'd have to buy a new house for a new rabbi coming in. This way, if Rabbi Yechiyahu of Weinberg marries the daughter of the previous rabbi, he's going to move into the house that the community already has provided for the previous rabbi, the previous rabbi, whose name escapes me now for a second. I'm losing my memory after, But you get it in chapter one of the book. So the altar told him, you should marry her. And Rabbi Yechiyahu of Weinberg marries her, even though she's 17-year-old girl who maybe could read Hebrew, but he had known girls who knew Russian and Hebrew. Maybe she could read Yiddish, I'm saying, the son of Verena. But Weinberg had known girls who knew Yiddish, knew Hebrew and Russian, who were intellectual. And this girl, they had nothing in common. Well, it's Rabbi Weinberg says, because of that, basically destroyed his life. But Rabbi Weinberg never mentions this publicly, but he was forced into this marriage by the altar, and it really, to a certain extent, destroyed his future prospects. Look, if the altar is the altar, and he tells you to do it, you listen to him. He tells us, Rabbi Weinberg tells us that, quote, they nearly put me in chevra, not permitting any student to study under me. This deprived me of my income. Since in those days, he says, the major source of earning from advanced students was tutoring less advanced students. In other words, so they told everyone not to, the younger Bachrim, not to study with Rabbi Yechiyahu Weinberg. One of his students, by the way, is younger Bachrim was Rav Aaron Cutler, incidentally. But they told the students not to go near this Yechiel Chechanovitz, they called him, Yechiel Chechanovitz, the Rabbi Yechiyahu Weinberg. So that took away income he had. Before we move on to tells, there's one other thing I saw in this book, which I love this book, about the Musar, about Slabodka Chevron Yeshiva by Shlomo Tykoshinsky. On pages 55 and 56, he says, actually, no, I don't actually. I don't know nothing else to report here. I've said everything, except that he mentions that after mentioning the throwing out of the yeshiva of the altar's son, Reuven, who then went to America, he says that Dov Katz, when he sorry, when the altar Dov Katz reports that when the altar came on Aliyah in 1925. He tried to figure out a way to create a kesher, a connection, and bring him to Eretz Yisrael, but it never happened. He in the note here, he says that he died young, but he had a family. And he says that Rabbi Finkel's granddaughter mentioned to him that Rav Yitzchak Scher, who was later Rosh Yeshiva of Hebron, met with Reuven, the son of the Alter, when in the 1930s, when he came to America to raise money. Rabbi Scher is the son-in-law, the other son-in-law the other son-in-law of the Alter Sabbatka. By the way, I said by mistake. I mentioned Rav Yitzchak Sarna has the son as the grandson-in-law of the Alter. He's the son of our Moshe Mordechai Epstein. In case one of you, Moshe, one of the two Moshes from Lakewood, would have pointed that out in the comments. But we still have two more minutes before I go to the questions. What we're going to do next, and we'll devote next class at least part of the time, is Tells. Because we also had a great revolution in Tells. But Tells is significant because Tells is an unusual yeshiva in other respects. That is, Tells, just as a yeshiva, functions a little differently. We'll talk about who led the rebellion against Musar in Tells, and you'll see why, Rev. In fact, I'm curious. Well, it's known because you can't cover it up because the sefer that everyone uses to talk about Tells mentions who the leader of it was. So, but I sort of think that had it not been revealed by Rabbi Yerucham Vorhaftig in his sefer, as I'll mention, I think maybe that it would not be mentioned by anyone else. And I have to check to see. We'll see next week whether it's mentioned who's the troublemaker in Tells next class. But now let me just get the questions. I'll make a note of this. Just a hint for those. I gave you a hint last class about Hillman. The nephew of the troublemaker in Tells, his nephew is a Nobel Prize winner. So, and feel free to put it in the chat. I don't care because we'll get to it next class. The nephew, who's a Nobel Prize winner, of course, was completely irreligious, atheist, the whole bit. But that was the 20th century, 19th century. Thank you all, Rabbi Dov. Thank you very, very much. Moshe mentions that the Yerushalmi is brought down in the Ramah, and he makes a distinction of people that work during the week and people who learn during the week. But yes, thank you. Which I do not recall that Ramah, although I've learned that Siman, I know. But whether that's what the Yerushalmi means or not, but you can make it, it makes sense. Moshe also says, I believe the Mechitzer Eloy, when he first saw American Bachrim playing ball, he started crying because he couldn't understand why they couldn't have the same outlet back in Europe. Yes, it's a famous story. In fact, in Jeffrey Gurock's book on Jeffrey Gurock, he has so many books. I don't know how he does it, but he has a book on Jews and America in sports. And he himself is a sportsman. He runs marathons. So he tells that story there. And the origin of the story is actually from a Meir Bar Ilan. Meir Bar Ilan told the story, and I can't remember now. There's a difference between how Bar Ilan tells the story and how he tells the story, because I think actually in Bar Ilan's version of the story, it's in Europe that he sees the children playing, and he says, "Why didn't they let us?" The story, as it's often repeated and is in Gurak, is that he's seeing the students from Yeshivas Yiritzo Chanan playing ball, and he says, "Why did they not let us play ball? We were in the same Talmidei Chachamim, but we would have had a childhood." Yes, as and now it's coming back to me. I'm certain that Bar Ilan, as he tells the story, it's actually in Europe that probably in Lida, because the Mechitzer, Rabbi Shlomo Polishek, he becomes the Rosh Yeshiva of Rinus' Yeshiva in Lida. Someone privately. The other Moshe says that Hershey Gordon writes that in conversation with Rav Shaul Eshel Levenberg, the latter commented that he knew the identity of the ones who desecrated the Musar volumes. However, he died before revealing the name to Gordon. Okay, so look, a lot of people knew it. Every single person who was in the yeshiva knew it. But for whatever reason, it hasn't come down to us. And there's There's a rabbi. He was rabbi in South Africa. He's from, let's see, Yehuda Leib Landau, and he wrote a book called Viduyim. And in there, he was chief rabbi in South Africa, and he was a great Hebrew poet. But he has a book, and he refers to certain people negatively in code. This person, that person. So I have a letter from someone to him asking him to reveal who are the people. And he actually reveals a number of them. One of them he says, I can't say because it's an important rabbi and I can't tell you. But the others he revealed. So sometimes it's tricky to find out the answers. Moshe says, how do Rav Burstein's views on Mussar coincide with his position at Merkaz HaRav? His position at Merkaz HaRav had nothing to do with his view at Mussar. The reason he got the position at Merkaz HaRav is because he was from his method of learning Torah was before it was, as they say, before Matan Torah. The Rav Kook did not want someone who taught in the analytic approach. We have the letter from Rav Harlap to Rav Shimon Shkup. Rav Shimon Shkup wanted to come to on Aliyah and become Rosh Hashiva at Merkaz, and Rav Harlap writes to him saying, "No, no doing." Because Rav Kook wants someone, as I said, pre-Matan Torah, from the old school of learning, not the new analytic approach. And so Rav Borstein, who was a great Rav, but it had nothing to do with Musser. In fact, by the time he goes to Merkaz, he recognizes that his position on Musser was wrong. Before he goes to Merkaz, he's in Tel Aviv. And a lot of students, I mentioned this last semester, start coming to hear his shiurim because he was considered a gaon shebagaoni. Him and really in his day, him and Rav Itzel Leponavej were considered, I think, the greatest Iluyim, the greatest Mechadshim in Lita. Now people haven't heard of him, and of course we say Reb Chaim. Kamenetsky records that they asked Reb Chaim, who's the greatest Mechadshim? They asked Reb Chaim, who are the greatest Mechadshim? And he says the greatest one I forget now. Basically, the upshot of the story was that the Reb Chaim saying, I think this is what he says, the only one he would acknowledge was greater than himself was Rav Itzel Leponavej, who, as I recall, they learned together b'chavrusa. But he didn't acknowledge that Rav Borstein was greater than him. But in his lifetime, Rav Borstein might have been regarded as the greater Mechadish. The Rav Itzel was regarded, I think, universally as the greatest Mechadish, greater than Reb Chaim in that time. But so Reb Borstein's in Tel Aviv, and Dov Katz mentions that he was one of the students, a Chevron guy who started going to a shiurim, and he says that Reb Borstein acknowledged that he was wrong, and that he sees today that the Musar yeshivas are the strongest. Maybe they were the strongest, and they were able to deal with the revolutionary fever better than any other yeshivas. So even the greatest opponent, Borstein of Tavrig, retracted or came to see the error of his ways. When would Reuven have been born? I guess probably the 18 eight, late 1880s, I would think, 1885, something like that. 1905, he's a troublemaker. So maybe he's 18 years old, 1887. That's the era. Thomas says there's a son, Robert Finkel, listed on Genie, born 1885. Dead born 1884. Okay, well, the time is correct. I'm sure there's more than one Robert Finkel, but that would be the time that he would have been born. And unfortunately, maybe someone could track it down. I don't know if at this late date it's possible. David, Shalom Aleichem, David, says not favoring one child is one thing, but the abuse that Reuven endured, in my mind, is something else. In Making of a Godot, Rav Kamenetsky quotes from Yisrael Shurin, who tells about the time the altar's wife overheard a few Slabodka students discussing a sichas musar being kind, and the wife remarked sarcastically, "My husband knows about kindness. He broke a cane when he struck his young son with it out of kindness." Okay, listen, we can't. I was referring to feelings of affection for children versus versus yeshiva students. But slapping students. We mentioned Shalamis Meiselman's book. She says that her father knew how to look. It says in Proverbs, spare the rod, spoil the child. That was a method of discipline in those days. And if you go to the museum in Rome, sorry, in Vienna, although this time we went, they didn't have it on the wall. But for you can go online and you could see it. There's an image there, a picture, a drawing on a Hebrew manuscript. from like the 1400s, which shows the Rebbe, the Melamed, sitting down and the students sitting in front of him, and the Melamed is holding a whip in his hand, like one of these little whips. I mean, that's how they used to do it. Someone asked me to hold up the sefer I showed. I think it's probably, this is, I think, the only sefer I showed today. Shlomo Tikashinsky's great book on Musar, Lamdonos, learning Musar and elitism. I've shown you this book before, and I love the title page because this is Slabatka. Moshe said, the biggest shame in Volozhin was if the Netziv slapped you. Yes, and if you look in Schachter's article on the closing of Volozhin, the dispute over Volozhin, he mentions a case there where the Netziv slapped someone, and the Netziv had to apologize. In other words, he suspected the person of something which wasn't true. I think maybe shaving with a razor, I forget. But yes, the Netziv would slap people. We can't imagine such a thing today. But the Rosh Yeshiva would, these were not 25-year-olds. These were many of these boys were 15, 16, 17, 18. And these were not slaps like Rav Avadia gave you the slap if you go on the videos. We can't, look, the whole way, our whole approach to education is different. And I think we think it's better. It's definitely better for us in this generation. The old way wouldn't work. But we can't be anachronistic and think that we have all the truth and the way we do it now is the way it always should have been done. Maybe yes, but I mean, yeah, we can't start judging our predecessors by who lived in a different era, and perhaps their way of doing it was the proper way. If you know something about the Lithuanian yeshiva world, you know that many Rosh Yeshiva, including Rav Soloveitchik, they would scream at students and they would even humiliate students. At least the students felt humiliated if they didn't learn the Gemara properly. Kamenetsky mentions a story where Rav Aaron Cutler called one of the students Parah Aduma, this redhead, because he didn't know the Gemara. I mean, that's what they did. Now, it always troubled me, obviously, but I remember seeing years ago Machiavelli. So it's before, a couple hundred years before, but I guess it's still pre-modern. Machiavelli writes how the way to encourage students to excel and to do better is to humiliate them. That is, embarrass them. If they don't know, if they come to school and they're not prepared, you embarrass them, and that will encourage them in the future to do better. I mean, there's a seichel to it. Today we'd see as obviously as completely inappropriate. So, but the idea that you'd scream at a student and you call him an Am Haaretz if he doesn't know it. In fact, it got to the point that if the Rav, Rav Soloveitchik, told you your Am Haaretz, that's a kavod. Rav Lieberman also, if he said your Am Haaretz is a kavod, because at least he thought it was worth telling you your Am Haaretz. He didn't just ignore you. We don't do it today, but it's and our students are snowflakes, and this will never fly, and parents will never allow it. But that's what they did it in Gerba. In Gerba, first time I was there, I'm in the school. In fact, let me pull it up on the screen and show you this. I think you'll find this interesting. Take a look at, hold on, let me pull it up here. We hope one day we can go back to Gerba. In fact, the guy, our local tour guide, he got married last week, and what a simcha it was to watch the wedding. He doesn't see his bride since the day they're engaged, a year and a half before. Wait, I should say he doesn't speak to her. He saw her, but on the streets. He couldn't speak to her. And then couldn't see her for like 2 weeks before until and when he does Hareyat Mekadeshet, she's covered by a veil, a thick veil. He couldn't even see her face. He has to rely on the Edim. So I guess what would be the question, the issue if it's the, our halachic scholars can discuss. Let's say he pulls up the veil and it's instead of Rivka, instead of Rachel, it's Leah. But so a year and a half, he couldn't speak to her, not on the phone, not text. I mean, okay. But so he just got married. It's a big simcha, and the video was great to watch of it. But Rabbi David Fine from Israel came on a Tunisia trip, made a special trip to Gerba. Him and a couple of Satmar guys also who had been there on the tour, a separate tour with Adir to the wedding. But when I'm in Gerba first time, I come in to the shul, and I'm going to show you what I saw in the shul. Here it is. And this was in the various shuls. So here you have all the students. This is printed. Let me turn it sideways here. You have the students, the names, you have their grades, in everything. So these are the little kids. But let me move on to some of the older kids. In Gerba, all you have is Torah. If you want secular studies, you hire someone. It's only Kodesh. So you have in the classroom, Yosef Day, what do you have? You have the students, you have Gemara, Shulchan Aruch, Navi, Pshat, Zarach, that's the Arabic translation, Tikkun Sofer, they all have to know the Parsha every week, with the Truppah, et cetera. Sfaradit is how to write in Spanish script. So you have the grades here. So here, 90, that's a good grade. What about if you're the guy at with the 52? Sorry, Naor Bitan, but you got a 52. Not so good. Then, so I asked someone, and I said, how can you do this? How can you put in all the shuls the grades of the students, especially the ones who aren't doing so well, the ones who are not going to be Rosh Yeshiva? So the person said to me, he says, first of all, we're all related. We're all family, which is true. They all intermarry each other. And so therefore, I guess it's not such a problem. And then he says, and besides, the students who don't do well, if they see this, they'll be embarrassed. By next report card, they'll do a lot better because they don't want the whole island to know that they got a 52 final grade. So again, if a teacher in our schools ever revealed a student's grade to someone else other than the parent, they'd be fired. But it's a different world. Okay. Yes, the grade. It's Rabbi Yellen, who joined us in Tunisia, and he will agree that this was an unbelievable trip. They do say the name of the father. Now, I think the reason they say the name of the father is because there's a lot of hadads and a lot of bitans, and you don't want to confuse them. So you say the name of the father, then you know who got the 52. Okay, thank you all for coming out tonight, Rabbi Kelman.
Yes, that's I can tell you as a teacher, you said it. You ever reveal the mark, you're finished. Reveal a comment, they say. But also the reminds you of the rugged shover. You know the famous story when Yosef Berg went to visit the rugged shover. You know that the rugged shover used to insult people left and right. So apparently I hear the story, but when Yosef Berg was young, he wanted to go meet him. He was a super genius. And they warned him, he insults people and, just be ready for that. So Yosef Berg went there, met them for half an hour, and he finished the meeting and he said he didn't insult me at all. Says that he, oh, no, he asked the rugged shepherd, they told me you insult people. Well, you didn't insult me. He says, I only insult Talmidei Chachamim. So that's the story I heard. But, anyways, okay. So,
The
all
next
right.
week tells. Next week he moved to tells. The
Yeah,
last yeshiva we're going to do.
I'm
Yes.
sorry. That's
The
the last
last
issue.
yeshiva we're going to do is tells.
Okay, that's fine. That's fine. Okay, everybody. Tomorrow, Marty Lakshin finishes his series on Slichot, history, geography, and theology of Slichot. And Rabbi Shulman is going to refer to what you said in Ezra, of course, the eighth parak, the Rosh Hashanah of Ezra that changed in Jewish history. That's tomorrow, Rabbi Shulman at 1 p.m. So that's tomorrow, 11 and 1. And then the rest of the regular shiur during the week. Adina Blaustein on Wednesday. Shuli's finishing up her series on Thursday, Parsha, then Maaseh in the Machzor on Friday. And I sent it out just before the Yom Kippur, Yom HaYunus. Those who are at the Rosh Hashanah Yom HaYunus, I hope you found it meaningful and enjoyable. So we're doing that in 2 weeks on Tzom Gedalia. Got nothing else to do on Tzom Gedalia. So, anyways, but we'll have our Yom Kippur, Yom HaYunus, seven speakers. I think it's a great lineup. And okay, we look forward to seeing you. All right, everybody, we should hear good news. It's and Mazel Tov again to Mark and the family. And okay, everybody, be well. Thank you, Lila Tov.
Rabbi Kelman,
Yes,
who is the guy whom the Rogatcher did not insult?
Yosef Berg. I heard this story. You know these stories.
You mean Yosselberg?
Yosef Berg, who was the politician for 50
Yeah, I
years in
know he was.
Naftal.
He lived in the same street as I lived in Leipzig.
He lived in the same street as what?
In Leipzig, he
Oh, okay.
as I was
Okay.
born.
I mean, Yosef Berg was quite an interesting guy, and but apparently he learned yeshiva. He wanted to meet him, you know, the Rogachover, and they asked him, "How come you didn't insult me?" You know, like so.
That is a fascinating story. Thank you so much.
Okay, what can I tell you? You know, but anyways, yeah. All right, everybody, Laila Tov.